next week my plan is, and always subject to change, that I want to do the pre-flood world. And as there usually is with these studies, there's not a lot of scripture to go on. So maybe it'll be hard to make an hour lesson of it. Well, there's a lot of stuff out there that they have found that I believe is pre-flood world that we can look at in terms of archaeology. So that's what we're going to do next week. We know the Bible says it was a terrible time. In fact, it was so terrible that God hasn't destroyed the world since. But he will yet again. So he destroyed the world with the flood. All right. I look for pretty pictures. I have no idea whether this is representative of the Garden of Eden or not. You had enough time to look at that, I guess, but it is pretty. Our segment for these lessons are from 4004 B.C. to approximately 2348 B.C., which is the year of the flood. We'll actually extend it past that a little bit, covered in Genesis chapter 2, most of chapter 2 up through 11. We stop short of Abraham, which includes the Tower of Babel, which is important in the overall scheme of things. Remember, these are the five events that need to be factored into our worldview. We understand that creation occurred by God, by the word of his mouth, made it out of nothing. We have a period of time where mankind, is in the Garden of Eden without children and are expelled. And we have this period we're going to talk about next week that's before the flood. Then we have the events surrounding the flood and the tremendous upheaval and change of the world's, the face of the planet, and it's reestablishing again some kind of an equilibrium that it is still trying to approximate today. So why we have these swings in temperature, and what we had 34 degrees in 1974, and this morning was only, what, 4 below? I don't know what you guys had, but something like that. So then we had Tower of Babel, so forth. So these are the five events that need to always be factored into our thinking, because it explains why things are the way they are. Now, as we intend to head toward a study of the flood, we want to pause on our way to look at some of the intervening events from creation, that is, after the creation of man, to the destruction by the flood. This should help us in our apologetic when we talk to people and try to engage them in discussions about the truth. In our explanation or understanding of evil, suffering, and conflict, we must factor in the conditions in the garden, that is, the conditions when the created world was perfect. The charge often is that God made the world as it is, and it's evil, and it's got all these conditions in it that of suffering and conflict, but we have to take that opportunity and say, it has not always been this way. And that leads you into a great discussion about when it wasn't that way, when it was good, and what happened when it got destroyed. So the charge that God made the evil world, or that evil, as according to evolutionists teach or say, that evil has always existed, fails to acknowledge a time when there was a perfect world. So we have learned this if we have been in church from kindergarten up. There's a perfect Garden of Eden where Adam and Eve lived in perfection for a few moments, as it seems. Well, we see all around us evil all around us, but as Christians, we know that it was not part of the created world. Here's your apologetic. And it's abnormal. Evil is abnormal in this world. It is not normal. But it's brought on the world by a righteous and just God, who in grace, on their other hands, provided a remedy, a reversal of the evil, assuming that just punishment on his own son on the cross. We know that as a summary of history. We now, after the cross, wait for the restoration of all things. The restoring of what? Well, really, the conditions of the garden. So there will be a day when we will have, again, as believers, a perfection. Romans 8:21 talks about this briefly, that creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption. This is inanimate objects are set free from the slavery to corruption unto the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So someday, you know, the earth here is personified, made to be like a person, and it too will be released from this bondage of slavery. So we have this also, and Gil just preached about this in Peter chapter 3, when Peter explains that Jesus Christ is appointed to you whom heaven must receive until a period of restoration of all things. This may be an immediate reference to the restoration of Israel as a nation or the kingdom, but it certainly must also refer further back than just the kingdom. So it is possible that the loss of to mankind in the Garden of Eden is remedied in that restoration. So that is the question. That is to say that the events of history will come back 360 degrees to the place of the original loss, and I think even better. We can't say heaven was, well, talk about Garden of Eden was a paradise, but there were still things that were untried. Mankind was untried, and when we'll come back to 360 degrees, there will be no testing of mankind any longer. And Satan will not have access to it like he did at the beginning. Now, we must caution against this Platonic Augustinianism. If you've been in my study for a few years ago, we are getting familiar with that term. Platon and Augustine, what is their philosophy? Well, that philosophy easily discards the creation or matter as evil and any material benefit of it, such as the joys and physical realm. Always sick cherry pie with ice cream is one of those things. That appreciation of food, shelter, clothing, technology should be kind of scorned. Because we don't live for this world. We live for a higher spiritual level. So we should not be subjugated. We should subjugate these material things to the real joy in the spiritual realm. Now, that sounds very, very spiritual, and that's what you get from covenantalism. Because everything is focused on salvation, and they sort of disdain the idea that we actually are attached to this world and that God will sometime redeem this world and that we should be happy about that because that is so materialistic. Well, that's Platonic Augustinianism. It's from Plato, a Greek philosophy, and it's Augustine who popularized it in Christian thought. So we have an example. I was running through the internet and I came across this thing, not looking for it. But this is what he says. These guys, Stephen and Doug, don't know them. He said, "Let us not live in the flesh or accept popular convoluted teachings that focus on an earthly state. Rather, let us live in the spirit." See, that's kind of makes sense, doesn't it? But wait a minute. God has redeemed us completely. The Garden of Eden will be redeemed completely. We will live in the millennium drinking water and having ice cream and cherry pie. I'm not sure we're going to have steaks, but we're going to have good stuff, you know? We'll see about the steak part. So salvation deals with the complete man, his personal being, and the corrupted estate. We're not just partially saved. I mean, not only us personally, but the realm in which we live, the body is to be redeemed too. So this idea that somehow that the spirit is the elevator and that's where the real good things happen and the things that are on earth are really ugly and disdainful. Well, they are in the sense that they're tainted by evil, but they weren't created that way. And in the restoration, we'll go back to Adam and Eve in the garden eating the fruits. And it says in Revelation chapter 22, the fruits in the garden there will bear different fruits every month and we'll enjoy them. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, the marriage of Feast of the Lamb is considered a feast of eating. And so we should look forward to that. So the physical world will be redeemed in the regeneration. So don't worry about that. And I won't warn you about the dangers of getting too attached to physical things. I don't think I need to do that. But we know there is a warning. So our study today is not about the fall, but about the place of it in the garden. The garden is a planned, by definition, the garden is a planned arrangement of plants and other features that support activities planned for it. So a garden always has that idea that somebody did something. I don't know that the wild, woolly plains would be considered a garden. you know, somebody had to do something. All right, well, God did something. He planted a garden for Adam and Eve, particularly Adam, and then Eve joined him. And the Lord planted a garden toward the east in Eden, and there he placed the man whom he had formed out of the ground and so forth and so on. I'm going to assume you know some of these passages. Well, this question, a little bit talk about it again later, but I just want to mention this issue about the east. The Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden. So it's the Garden of Eden because the garden is in Eden, but Eden isn't the garden. Okay, there's a garden in Eden. But we know it's east, but we don't know, except that it is by convention east of Jerusalem. I mean, everything is measured from Jerusalem. Somebody said, I don't know whether this is true. You might like to enjoy finding this out. Those languages that are east of Jerusalem read from right to left. Those languages that are native to the west read from left to right, supposedly pointing towards Jerusalem. Now, I don't know my languages, so you might see that doesn't work. Now, you have to go back and find where the languages come from, like Eastern language. I have no idea how they're written. I know the Hebrew language goes from right to left.
Arabic
does too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Iraqis, they read.
Okay.
Opposite.
So we got something going here.
Also right,
okay. So, you know, I sometimes love these little signs that the Lord gives us, you know, without telling us what they are. And they're not conclusive, but it's interesting how the Lord is interested in details, if that bears out to be true. All right, so we have east in the garden. Well, the Garden of Eden, a place that is well watered. I think there's probably a lot of definitions for it. It certainly is a pleasant place. It's one of the great stories of the Bible. The story of Adam and Eve, our first parents. What did they look like? We wonder what the color of the skin. They always show them in our Western world, blonde hair, blue eyed, slim and trim. And I don't think that's how they looked. I don't know how slim and trim they were, but I don't think they were white skinned. They're probably somewhat fairly dark. You know, you got to kind of pick an average between the darkest and the lightest and say that's probably what they were. Because, you know, there's no such thing as races. As God created them, we were one race. And people groupings and so forth over time and where they chose to live and the color of the skin somehow became families, and that's what we have today. So we wonder about this, wonder how they lived, we don't wonder what they ate. We know what they ate, what was on the tree, some things they shouldn't have eaten. What was it like to live in the paradise and so forth? What was their work day like? And they did work, by the way, you know. It was called unproductive work. That's what they were cursed to. If you ever don't know what unproductive work is, ladies, you should know. You do the same thing again and again and again and again. There's no production. You just have to keep on doing it. And same for men. We have to keep on doing the same old thing, the same old thing. But in paradise, your work has production. It does something. Every time you do something, there's a return from your effort. So, but our question is not about these interesting questions. It's about the evil, about Eden. Where is Eden? Now, God planted a garden for Adam. Adam inhabited after his creation. God made Eve, and she inhabited the garden with Adam. And it was in the garden that Satan deceived Eve, and Adam was followed in disobedience. It was in the garden that the judgments were made on the serpent, Eve and Adam. It was in the garden the clothing of skins were made for Adam and Eve. They weren't kicked out, and then, you know, clothing was made in the garden. But it was from the garden that Adam and Eve were expelled. The garden became a protected site forbidden to Adam and all the descendants. But there we know that there is going to be a restoration, I believe, of this garden when the restoration of all things occur. We had those passages already. All right, where is the traditionally located garden? Well, in Mesopotamia, and if you don't know where that is, it's this region here. We call it the Fertile Crescent. It now houses Iran to the south, to the east, and Iraq actually sits over these rivers. You have Syria, and you have Lebanon, and we have Israel, and Jordan, a new nation that's not ever talked about until 1948, about this nation got created out of nothing. So we have Jordan sits in the middle of the borders on Iraq, part of it. So it's been said, or supposed, or guessed that it's in Mesopotamia, connected with the civilization after the flood was established here. I mean, that's a backwards association, but it's the same place where the flood was. Samaria, Babylon, Ur is where Abraham came from. The Tower of Babel probably is in this area. I don't know, by association, perhaps they decide that maybe because of the watering, the rivers, the names of the rivers being there, they'll probably pick that. But there's no real reason for this location, except the rivers. Talked about that. Do you have the Euphrates River? Euphrates River is getting mixed up on the west and the Tigris on the east. They're long rivers. They go, they start on the headwaters up here in Armenia, and they're long, long rivers and dump into the Persian Gulf. So those are the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates, and they are mentioned in Genesis, and that's probably why that location is picked. Another shot of it, and you don't see, it's very much like Garden of Eden today, pretty sandy. And the ruins we have here of this Eridu, I'm not acquainted with this site. I just picked it because it was a nice map with the river showing on it. Well, the trouble with that spot is the drainage plane has to be reversed. If you think about it, we're going to do this later, but I got to tell you now that the low part of the river is here, right? Now, just think about what it says, that there was a fountain or a spring in the garden. If it actually watered the garden. But the water came out of it. And out of it came two rivers or two streams. Out of those streams came two more. So we have a source on the top of the hill branching out to at least four rivers at the bottom of the hill. This whole system is not a spring. It's a watershed. So if you're going to put it at the top, we'd have to put the Garden of Eden over here, and that's one of the options I give you later on. But I just want you to know that if you put it down here, the drainage plane would have to reverse. You'd have to tilt it the other way. I guess we can do that, if you're God. But maybe we don't have to do that. All right, so here's my point. The choice of this is based on the river names. The problem is we use the rivers as identifiers as they are described in Genesis. Then the garden is located at the wrong end of the river, at the discharge rather than at the headwaters. So the common river function is to drain a watershed or river basin, and that's not what we have in the garden. There we're water's flooding the garden, if I use it that way, rather than it being brought into the garden from another plane. So Genesis has a unique landscape. It says Genesis 2:10 says, now a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and it came, and from there it divided and became four rivers. This is the old system in the discharge of the Gulf to the Gulf, and this is the way the Bible talks about it. This water source must have been gigantic. I'll give you some help here in a moment. This water source must have been gigantic because if you think about the number of square kilometers or miles, however you want to look at it, it would have to water. Think about the Missouri River. I mean, the watershed is fairly large, so it takes a lot, and that just takes water off of it. It doesn't necessarily put it back on. So this would have to be a big, huge spring. Now, I think we have some help later on when we see this in Ezekiel, when we find that the water starts out in the New Jerusalem on earth, a stream that's small. And then as it gets away from the temple, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So we got a miraculous stream there. And I imagine that's probably what we have here in the book of Genesis, is a stream that's kind of like the widow's flower. You know, it just kept on multiplying as it got out. So these rivers, apparently there's no discharge because the land absorbs the river water, and the land is irrigated from below. All right, so we have an opposite picture here than what we would have in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. Any clues? Well, east. East is kind of a need some help here. If in the East, but that's really no help. But if I told you that I came from the East, what would you? You would ask me East of what, wouldn't you? East, would you from Asia? Or are you from the Middle East? Or are you from Eastern United States, Eastern Nebraska, Eastern Lancaster County, or just from the East? We need a reference point to determine where East starts. We don't have that given specifically in the Bible unless, as I already have suggested to you, we start with Jerusalem. But this is what Genesis does. There are six Easts in chapters 1 through 11, but there's no North, there's no South, and there are no written references. It's all East. So we have everything from Jerusalem. Jerusalem, I'm saying, going to end up being there. From this point, at least Garden of Eden, probably I think going to be in Jerusalem. Everything waters to the east. Now, we have today the Mediterranean Sea, just a few miles along that, they call the mountain ridge, middle of Israel, the mountain district, hill country. To the western shore, you have the Mediterranean Sea, but we don't know that the Mediterranean Sea was there before the flood. So we don't know what's west of here. So everything is oriented to the east of here. And I guess if we don't worry about what's still west of it, we can live with it. In fact, we're going to have to. Now, we have one other place. We have east of Eden, and that's where Cain was exiled after he killed Abel. He was, it didn't say he was sent out of Eden, but it's implied that he was sent out of Eden, not the garden, but Eden, and he was to dwell east of Eden. So the problem we have, obviously, is one of the problems we have is the flood. Universal flood would have destroyed the face of the earth. It is known that the flood reordered as much as 5,000 or up to two miles thickness of the crust of the earth. This destruction would have obliterated the garden, if that would be true everywhere. I'm not saying it's true everywhere. But there are places like Grand Canyon, they figure you go down the bottom of the Grand Canyon and get on the Colorado River and you see the rock down there, that's probably the indigenous rock. And everything from that point up has been brought in as a result of the flood. And we'll get into that when we do our flood study. And that's only 5,000 feet deep. So some places it's 10,000 feet deep. Now that seems like a lot, but remember we got 7,000 miles to deal with in a diameter of the earth. So the Mesopotamian identification has some problems, at least if we are to judge it by the post-flood geography. Now the flood likely changed the world entirely, thus our present-day maps are not reliable for locating pre-flood locations, unless God intended that there be some connection as the location of the rivers, and we have to leave that as an open possibility. The very names of these rivers must leave that option open for consideration. Somebody suggested that the only names they could think of rivers after the flood, therefore they named those rivers. I think that's kind of funny, but they probably could have come up with another name if they wanted to. So it was something there that somehow was supposed to be remembered and mark something. Now we have established the assumption for the garden to be located in Mesopotamia, somewhat weak. So we want to suggest an alternative location along theological lines rather than rely on physical evidence. I like these wonderful stories, pictures. Adam and Eve, and they got their boys, Cain and Abel, they're still hanging around at the gate, see if they can get back in. Not going to work. And apparently that Garden of Eden gate was still there, probably until the flood. And it was guarded, so no one could go in. All right. After the fall into sin, God made his first dramatic ongoing judgments on man. God pronounced judgment on the serpent. Remember the order? On Eve and then on Adam by cursing the ground from which he was taken. That's an interesting turn of events. God took Adam out of the ground, made him a being out of the ground, and then God makes him tend the ground, kind of. We'll call it poetic justice, I guess. And to that ground that he has to till, he will return. In the meantime, he will struggle in unproductive work. Well, was the garden in the area known later as Jerusalem? Question mark. Jerusalem in Eden. Now remember, Eden is a larger place, and the garden was in Eden. Well, think about this. As God pronounces judgment on Adam while in Eden, surely he would not grasp the reality of the new world he was going to face. That would soon change. Even before experiencing the outside, God made provision for Adam and Eve. Remember in Genesis 3:21, Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. So we have in the garden, not out of the garden, in the garden, was the first place of redemption. Now, we know it's temporary. We know it took animals to die to provide this covering. But it occurs in the garden. It occurs in the garden from which they're subsequently discharged, but they're not discharged immediately. I'm going to build a little case for Jerusalem. Now, we have the King of Peace, the King of Salem. Jerusalem, as it was later known, we have Genesis 14, 18 and 19, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. This is now with Abraham, about 2000 BC. Now he's a priest of the Most High God, and he blessed Abraham, and he said, blessed be Abram, name's not changed yet, of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and the earth. We know the story about Abraham went to him, and king of Salem is Jerusalem. And you've heard me guess at this. I think this is Shem, one of the three sons of Noah. And he does live into Abraham's time quite a while. And it would make total sense that if he carries the godly line forward, that he would make contact with Abraham. There's nothing said about it in the Bible that is identified, but it seems to me like a dead-end street, dead-end for Shem to die off and not pass the baton on. Furthermore, that would be the way that Abraham would have got records from Adam, from Noah, from Adam, and so forth, that later on Moses would have used to write the Pentateuch. So we have an interesting point here, that Jerusalem again shows up in a prominent spot by King of Salem. Why was he there? He has 150 million other places he could have gone around the world. But no, he went to Jerusalem. And Abraham recognized him as his superior. Now, if this is Shem, I always get Shem, Ham, and Japheth with the son of Adam mixed up. So, I mean, if I say it wrong, excuse me. I'm talking about the son of Noah. He lived to be hundreds of years old, 600 years old, I think, something like that. We can look it up. Anyway, there are other contemporaries. Abraham is born 2 years after Noah dies. So, you know, sometimes we get these real long time spans of ancient, you know, and even the evangelicals and years back used to talk about the world was probably created 10 or 25,000 years ago, but probably not more than that. That's all been brought back to more what we call the Usher chronology, which has taken the Bible's chronology out of Genesis and accepted it as it is, and you come to this point of view. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just collapses everything. Instead of having all the strung out people and no connection between this generation, you've got 25 generations between these people. I mean, what can be carried on? But now all of a sudden you have these men are being contemporaneous with each other. Now notice here, these are the few people you have to get to Abraham. These are contemporaneous people. I mean, each one knew the other above and below them. So we don't have a lot of time lost here. All right. So we have another incident. Now it's going to be called Mount Moriah. But Jerusalem is on Mount Moriah. Abraham takes his son, his only son. God tells him, the one you love, go to the land of Moriah, and there offer him as a burnt offering. So we have another instant where in Jerusalem, God does something spiritual, significantly powerful. Now we have, jump forward, we have Solomon. Where is the temple going to be built? Well, it's going to be built on Mount Moriah. It's where David bought the land that used to be a threshing floor. So again, Jerusalem comes up. We have Mount Moriah in the city of Jerusalem is the place where God meets man. It's a place where man meets God. The land where the temple is. It's where God is going to do his work amongst humanity. So we move to the provision of redemption in the person of Christ. Remember, the first redemption was in the garden. First sign of redemption. He is arrested, tried, crucified in Jerusalem. The crucifixion is outside the city. Functions in the role of the scapegoat, incidentally. But Jerusalem is one and the same place, which includes Mount Moriah, the north-south ridge, including the original sacrifice mount, City of David, where the temple was built. So I have this dotted line. Basically, that ridge is called Mount Moriah. It isn't a mount that sits like this. It's a ridge line. All right. So, statements about Jerusalem. What is this place? We have a statement in the future in Ezekiel 38:12. As the people bring the goods and cattle to the Jews, it's called that they're going to the center of the world. Jeremiah 2:7 talks about the land, that this land that we're talking about is my God calls it my land. That's not an unusual idea here for us as dispensationalists. We believe it's God's land. All right, it's my inheritance. And my inheritance, you made an abomination. He's criticizing Israel at this point, but it's his land. We have in Zechariah 2:2, it says, this man says, I'm going to measure Jerusalem, see how wide it is and how long it is. And we find out that he goes on to say that he who touches Jerusalem touches the apple of his eye. So if you don't, you probably knew this already, but all of a sudden, maybe Jerusalem really is a very important place. Maybe it doesn't just start with Christ coming there, you know, to be crucified. Maybe it had some significance before. Well, it obviously did. The temple was there, but Abraham was there with his sacrificed son. Abraham met Melchizedek there already. So we have this long line of history with Jerusalem. All we got to do is project a little bit backwards, and we'll get to the Garden of Eden. So we have this idea, again, center of the world. It's translated in the Authorized Version. At one place, even the navel, you know, the middle part of your body, the center of the world. I guess it makes sense that the Lord would have the navel in the middle of the body, and we kind of funny come off our ear. So I guess it's probably in the middle of our body. We have Ezekiel 30:47 again, talking about the millennial temple, and he brought me to the back door of the house, the temple, and behold, water was flowing from underneath the threshold of the house towards the east, and in this case, water was also flowing from to the west, so it shows it somewhere south on the altar. So we have water coming out of the temple, which is a fountain. And I just met this man, Manfred Kohler, this last year at the pre-trip conference. And I'd seen this drawing before. I never knew who drew it. So I figured, well, I'll bring it. Because he does a little nice job of this. Here's Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, not the new Jerusalem in heaven, the new Jerusalem on earth. And he shows his temple here in the water going out to the Mediterranean Sea. By the way, now the Mediterranean Sea does exist west of Jerusalem because we're after the flood. And we have the water flowing out of the west eastern side and through the split of the Mount of Olives and out to the Jordan River. And he shows us the Dead End Sea. I think what this will be, eventually this will go out and be at sea level. All you got to do is put enough water into the Dead Sea and it will be at sea level. You know, that's what happens. So this is a picture of that. And it talks about that there in Psalm 46:4, it says, the river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy dwelling place of the Most High. We're talking about Jerusalem here, and there's a river there. And I could not find it, look for information on this, but I know there's an underground river there because there is a fountain at the Gihon Springs. And it probably flows a lot less now than it used to because there's so much water taken out of Israel, the aquifer system. Zechariah 14:8 talks about in that day, well, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and the other half towards the western sea, something we already saw in Ezekiel. This is our old friend Clarence Larkin from back in the early 1900s. He's got the same drawing with this, with the threshold being to the south and the water running to the west and the water running to the east and to the Dead Sea. There's similarity in the fountains in the garden and the fountain in the new earthly Jerusalem. The water source is a fountain that the water multiplies as it moves from its source. In Revelation 22, we have towards the end of our record of God's revelation, and he showed me a river of water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and the Lamb. In the middle of the street, on either side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit. So they bury different ones every month, and nations come there for the healing. So the Garden of Eden had the tree of life. It was forbidden to eat from the tree of life, but Adam and Eve were kept from it after they sinned. But here I think we'll be encouraged as residents of this new Jerusalem in this new Garden of Eden setting to eat from the tree of life and enjoy its taste and its benefit. So summarizing this section, if we were to pick a holy site on earth where God has done and will do great marvelous things, we have no other place to look than to Jerusalem. You can look in Omaha, Chicago. I mean, there's not Baghdad. There's no other place. It's Jerusalem. Since there is much symmetry in the work of God, could we not suggest that the Garden of Eden be located in the land? Perhaps the center of the garden in Jerusalem? We're not going to be dogmatic on this. None of us are going to lose the salvation if we don't figure this out. But it's plausible. That's my word for my classes are plausible. Is it plausible? Does it work? Is there some possibility that it would work? Is there something that's wrong that would be contradictory? Now, Jewish legend claims that the fountain stone of creation is actually Mount Moriah. And we were in Jerusalem last time, help me, Larry, or whoever, that when we were at Calvary, the church, somebody came out of there and said that they were told that Adam was created there. Remember that? Did you see a placard or something? You know, just heard somebody say it. Yeah. So I just, oh no, come on, you know, this is the Mesopotamia, that's where Adam was created. Now, I said, the Catholics aren't always wrong. They're just wrong on very important things. All right, so I was going to chase that down, and I didn't find any answer to that one. But the Jewish legend is that the foundation stone is Mount Moriah. I mean, I don't know how the world is built on Mount Moriah unless it's the center of the earth, you know, and that's metaphorical perhaps, but maybe it's really literal in how God looks at it. You know, so where is the center of the earth? Where is the navel of the earth? He points his finger towards Jerusalem. Does it have a bump there? Does it wobble? No, that's just the way it is. That's just what he's picked. It's the spot he chose to do his miraculous works. Well, there is actually some support for this in the scripture, this notion. We've just gone through a lot of those passages for you. Note that the garden is in Eden, and it was from the garden Adam was expelled, but they may have continued to live in Eden. And Cain was removed to the land of Nod, east of Eden, so he didn't even get to live in Eden. He was end up being a vagabond. Okay, can the lost garden be archaeologically discovered? The answer is no. Prime reason is not that the flood destroyed it, but that God protected it. Now, we've been through every square inch of Israel, but it's not to be found there. It may be out of phase, but you can't see it. But there are some things we can observe and determine as plausible. A plausible location for the location of the garden. So how lost is it? Well, we can narrow it down. We know it's not in the Western Americas, so we're probably going to stick somewhere around the Middle East. Well, there are other views. Africa is suggested as the cradle of mankind, if you're listening or reading anthropologists. All of Africa has been suggested that the idea likely comes from the finds of old human bones. If the oldest bones are here in Eastern Africa, then the Garden of Eden had to be here. Well, they don't believe in the Garden of Eden, do they? No, they don't. So, but if you need it, you always can refer to it. All right. So that's them saying it. But we say that there are no biblical markers that would suggest Northern or Eastern Africa. Now, according to researchers from Tel Aviv, now we're talking Jewish, they have uncovered finds that indicate the existence of modern man, Homo sapiens, in Israel as early as about 400,000 years ago. And wherever I read, they all say that Homo sapiens really didn't arrive on the world until about 50,000 years ago. Boy, we got a big discrepancy here, don't we? But anyway, this calls into question the widely held view that Africa was the birthplace of modern man.
Gopher?
Gopher, that's the man's name.
Doug.
Hmm?
Gopher. Duh.
Nothing but humor here. That's all right, so this place is called the Afar or Afar Triangle in Eastern Africa. It's up in this spot. This is what it looks like. This is where Lucy was found. You know Lucy. And just bring this little site here because tell me this is the Straits of Hormuz. Yes, thank you. I could not remember it. You know what? They want to build a bridge across that strait. It'd be the longest single-span bridge in the world. And you know why they want to build it? Now think a little bit. Not too hard.
Huh? Pirates?
No. Where are you? What part of the world are you in?
Oil.
What's even better than oil? Muslims. To get to Mecca. To get to Mecca. Right. It's, I don't know, I said how many, $30 billion for the bridge. Now, it's not going to leap from one bank to the other bank, but because there's some islands in there. Anyway, you can read about it if you want to. Look it up. It's been started. It's on hold right now because of some, obviously, dispute about something. All right, that's nothing to do with anything, except that's the place where this Afar spot is, where Lucy is found in those places. There's another satellite shot. This is that triangle. Kind of pretty place. Wouldn't want to live there. I'm going to skip that for now. Okay, now, looking for existing geography, what can we see? You know, what can we look at that might give us some clue? Well, we decided that Garden of Eden is the wrong place. If it's on the Tigris-Euphrates, it would have to be up here. But the location of the garden up there without tipping the drainage plain is not a good location. This is no man's land. I mean, what did God do up here? Well, the land of the Ark. That's up here in Armenia, about in here. No, about in here. Here we go. About there. But, you know, they didn't stay there. They headed south right away towards warmer weather. So out of Genesis, we have now the river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it divided and became four rivers. And the name of the first was Pishon. It flows around the whole land of Havilah. And there was gold, and gold of that land is good. The bellium and the onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It flows around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is Tigris. It flows east of Assyria, and the fourth river is Euphrates, maybe towards Assyria. So suggested that these are the places. Cush is sometimes considered Africa. All right. So applying this model to a modern map, what do we have? We'll add one more thing. We've got the Tigris-Euphrates, and now they have found, and I just take their word for it because I cannot verify this, but I've seen it more than one map, that they, by satellite imagery, have found a wadi, a dry riverbed, through Arabia here, and they consider that's probably Pishon, the third river. The Gihon is not listed here. All right, so that river is right through there. So we got 1, 2, 3 rivers. Now, let's mark these rivers out. We have these two rivers, this one that's in the dry bed, and the Gihon River. There's no reason why it wouldn't be part of the Dead Sea Rift here. I mean, it's low, it's buried, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Now, using the known riverbeds, what connects these rivers together? Now, I'm going to ask you that question. See if you can come up with it. What geological feature connects these four rivers together? Now, if you don't get it, that's okay. But interesting, what is it? Something connects these rivers. These rivers all have something in common. Right. Who said that? If I had a cookie, I would give it to you. All right. The Syro-African Rift Valley, which starts up here and goes clear down here and into Africa. All of these rivers touch on that rift. Now, this is a huge rift. This is not just some little crack in the earth. And remember, it gives us the lowest point on the earth. Lowest point on the earth. The Sea of Galilee is 600 feet below sea level. The Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level. The Jordan River from the beginning to the end is all below sea level. It's a low spot in the earth. Something happened when that collapsed, and it changed the face of that world. And there are still earthquakes going on in there, and we're looking, not forward to, but anticipating another earthquake. A little bit to the west of this, contingent to this fault line, is a fault line that runs through the Mount of Olives, which, and it will split. All right, so let's look at what this looks like here. There's our rift line. So the Syro-African Fault or Syro-African Rift is what holds these together. All of these yellow lines are tied or are in proximity of. So we're making some approximations here. So theological reasons we have so far that God for God to do his work with man at Moriah. The garden spawns four rivers to water the Garden of Eden. Two survive by God's will. Two are lost. It can be summarized by deduction and discovery that these are the ones that have been lost, or we don't know where they are, although one of them, supposedly that Pison, has been suggested to be found. So that would put the garden, the spring fountain for the water, somewhere along the Rift Valley here. And since it would be convenient to have near Jerusalem, we'll just, why not? Okay. So what changes in the geography will make this possible? Let's wind the clock back. Well, one thing, we have to raise the rift valley, won't we? Raise it up. Well, if you, and now, by the way, I mentioned to you, it's the lowest point of the earth. Is there some symbolism here? In fact, there is, whatever you call it, myth or rumor or talk, that the rift valley is the abyss where people go. You know, I don't know whether I want to get that literal, but I think we'll be sometimes surprised in eternity how literal God has been. We say, well, that's just a figure of speech. So it's a place where you don't want to be. So that's probably why that's gotten that kind of name or that kind of reputation. But it is the lowest part of the earth. Now I think, wow, here we go from the Garden of Eden, which was kind of the highest part of the earth because that's where the water came from, and it all flowed down from there. Now all of a sudden we got next to the garden, or probably part of Eden, now is below sea level, lowest part of the earth. Maybe that was part of God's judgment. All right. Okay. So we have waters of Jerusalem in the millennium are miraculous. The spring starts out small and grows in volume and in the distance, ankle deep to swimming. This is water that multiplies itself. This could be the kind of water that flowed in the garden. Otherwise, the river would need to be huge to irrigate thousands of square miles indicated by the rivers. So we have come now, full circles. And it says that in Revelation, the churches, I forget which church we're talking about here, must be Philadelphia, I'm not sure, 2:7. He who has ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which will be fed from the water from that spring in the new Jerusalem, in the paradise of God. So we're back in the Garden of Eden. All right, so just to remind you a little bit, the new Jerusalem is down here. In this section down here, we see the water go to the west and to the east. And these are the divisions of the land as they will be in the millennium. They're different than they are during our Old Testament record. Okay, so the summary is then, and I'll have a couple questions for you, so think about some. What God did on earth was ruined by man, but God will restore both man and paradise again, using one locality, the place he calls the center of the earth, the apple of his eye. And though the ownership of the land and the city is hotly disputed today, it is clear that in the end, God will control it and exterminate sinners from it. And so we say, even so, Lord Jesus, come, Maranatha. Okay, that's far. So you have some questions, perhaps. Let me stop, pause the recording here.
We have that rift at the end of the tribulation world going into the millennium being raised up.
Well, it doesn't say that it is, because it says the water is going to flow from Jerusalem out to the...
Could be made... the language was there, or Ezekiel, be the mountain of God. Seems to me it would indicate that it would be raised up.
Well, but, yeah, I think something says that it'll be the highest point on the earth. Maybe that's what you're thinking about. Yeah, it could be, my son-in-law says, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be the highest plain on earth, okay? That means it's going to be really, really high. Because Mount Everest is 30-some thousand feet unless the world had changed. And I think there can be renovation again of the world before the millennium starts. So, but it could be metaphorical. Here I go again. That is the highest point of the earth. But it will be, Jerusalem will be considered that high point. So does it mean that it's been growing up? Well, that land isn't that big. You know, so there isn't room for a sound, mountain that big or that tall. Yep.
Down, has there ever been a determination of these water sources of the pools lying north and south of the old Temple Mount? Where that water is from, it's so much, that area is so much higher than the Jordan Valley.
Yeah. Well, you know, the water that Herod, I think, brought into Jerusalem comes from north from Hebron. There's aqueducts, so they have more water into Jerusalem than just what comes from the Gihon Spring. The Gihon Spring isn't all that big. This next time we go there, I hope to be able to see that. I'm not sure I want to walk through the tunnel, but to see it. And I understand that it's not all that much water. I mean, it still would be like this, but I mean, it's not like a terrible amount of water. It depends how fast it flows too. But there's been new water brought in, fresh water brought in from the north. And I think they still do. And that's interesting, because where does that water come from? It has to come from rainwater, because there's nothing higher that would actually feed it. Like Mount Hermon feeds Galilee, but there's nothing like that there. Unless it's pumped up from below the real deep in the bowels of the earth, as they say, which is possible.
Yeah, the source doesn't mean whatever source derives from this doesn't appear to be great, but it's been flowing continuously for a long time.
But these underground aquifers are really hard to find. You know, we have the Ogallala aquifer here, and every few years somebody comes up with a new theory how it's replenished. And then they say, oh, no, that's not true. Now, last I heard, they say, well, it's, you know, it was mountain snow from the Rockies for years, and now we're back to rainwater. So who knows? I mean, you can't dye it and then to find it, and so it's kind of hard. So that's probably true with Jerusalem water. They don't know for sure where it comes from. Well, all they know is they don't have enough of it.
The Garden of Eden, are you thinking it was preserved until the flood?
Probably.
But not really any reason why.
Well, it doesn't say it was destroyed. That's the only reason I would say. And when a flood came, then it would, by definition, be destroyed.
But it'd be guarded what? By angels?
By the angels, yeah. And I guess this probably gets into our next week's lesson, just what was life like before the flood? And I do think that the world was covered with people. And I'll show you a reason why that probably is true. I mean, probably covered to the extent that we're covered the world today. So would these people know about this place in what we call the Middle East as a place where there are angels watching that no one goes in? I mean, would that be common knowledge? I mean, it could be. And what?
Not to get ahead of
sure.
Ahead of what maybe you have for next week, but you mentioned earlier maybe some pre-flood artifacts. So you're going to mention something about that.
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to work at that. There's some a lot of the stuff that's really, really difficult will be for me, and I keep thinking, good thing I don't go to heaven on my testimony or my stuff I teach here, especially this kind of stuff, because the change is so fast. And there aren't believer guys that are doing any work. I'm reading a book now that's not written by a believer, but it's fascinating stuff. So much of that, I said, you know, that would fit the pre-flood civilization. And some really wild stuff. I mean, like even the pyramids, maybe pre-flood, because the evidence that these are actually built by the kings or pharaohs that say they're built by, that you, if you knew what the evidence that that's the evidence for that is, it's so flimsy you almost could discard it out of hand. So then, where did these come from? And then I was reading about the Sphinx. Well, the Sphinx was connected, getting into next week's lesson, the Sphinx connected with the Middle Pyramid. Well, if the Sphinx was there and the Middle Pyramid was there, those big pyramids were there during the flood, well, then the Sphinx had to be during the flood. And then about the next paragraph, I read that the guy, and this guy believes that all the flooding that occurred in the world came from the glacier. Even down in the Egypt, you got water from the glacier. I'm thinking, this guy's got to be nuts. Excuse me. But everything where there's a flood came out of the glacier. So now he's saying there's evidence of the Sphinx that it's been underwater. See, but believer guys that have, they're not doing work in this area now. I don't know. So I have to read these other guys and try to, you know, I pray to the Lord, don't let me get off the boat here. But still, those guys see stuff. They do Machu Picchu and all those, and the Incas and the Mayan and the calendars and so forth that they developed, they didn't really develop. It was came from an earlier people, and because these people were, and this whole idea that these civilizations occurred there and they were so advanced. Again, this thing about how the pyramids were built, you look at them, you walk away and say, well, that's nice. But you start analyzing what it took to build those pyramids, how fast they had to put a block and how many blocks they put down in a minute to get the thing built in 20 years is incredible. And how closely they fit. We don't have the engineering skills to do that today. Somebody did it, though. So how did they do it? So now what you have, these guys coming up with these are unbeliever guys now. They're doing this work. They're saying if this is true, it totally destroys the evolutionary model. They're saying it. Because they're saying that man was dumb and ignorant and illiterate and couldn't add two to two, two with two. But then they have sophisticated work with pi, you know, work 3.14 and 1.6, and it works into a lot of the geometrics of what they built. So all of a sudden you say, well, yeah, they just wait for the Lord to just show everybody up. So anyway, that's kind of what we're doing next week, and there's going to be some guessing on it, but doesn't hurt to guess as long as you know I'm doing it, all right?